Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society equips and encourages Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and believe it or not, this is our 100th episode. Way back in May of 2022, we released episode one, where Ciceronian Society President James Patterson and I discussed the hopes and vision for the Ciceronian Society and for this podcast generally. I encourage you to revisit that and just see how far we've come since then. This show was and is just a small piece of what we're doing, but neither James nor I thought we would get to 100 episodes in just a little over 4 years, or that we'd have two shows released on a weekly basis. But here we are. God is good. Of course, by that point, at episode one, the Ciceronian Society had already existed, or at least had already been incorporated for a decade, surviving on a little more than prayers, friendship, and beer. But what started as a tiny enclave for scholars in the humanities and social sciences has now seen growth in every aspect of our mission, programming, and reputation. Through prayer and the generosity of donors, we have substantially reinforced, as it were, the former wooden structure of our house with steel. Thankfully, our foundation was already strong, grounded in our faith, the classical and Christian tradition, and our distinctive commitment to place. That foundation has only improved with time and generosity. Much work remains to be done, of course, but we are very encouraged by the framework on which the Ciceronian Society's future will be built. Part of that framework and part of what we believe makes for a healthy civilization is well-formed educators and scholars. In keeping with the agricultural metaphor of this show, we need sowers and people who know how to plant the seeds of intellectual discipleship conducive to a civilized world. Such individuals are crucial to help make sense of our physical, historical, and spiritual context, especially when change occurs at the unprecedented pace we are all experiencing. But meaningful intellectual formation is not acquired with the pursuit of paychecks and credentials. Scholars and educators need friendship. They need networks of fellow Christians who speak the truth in love and love the truth they speak. They need venues for presentation and publication where other scholars take them seriously and provide honest feedback as friends. Sadly, this just isn't the experience of many of today's scholars and educators. Those who are blessed by quality formation, if they were able to get it on their way to an academic or scholarly career, often lack the community that sustains that life of the mind. No, they don't get it at the universities and colleges that used to provide that. I mean, I know there are exceptions, but it's just no longer the default. It's no longer the case, especially for Christians. By God's grace and with your continued support, the Ciceronian Society will be the premier organization filling that void for Christian scholars across the United States and beyond. Together, we're preserving that Christian life of the mind and community to pass on to future generations in classrooms and pews around the world. Holding fast to God's word, his beloved church, the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and the promise of Christ's return, we can be the group sustaining Christian educators, thinkers, and writers for generations to come. If that's a vision you find compelling, please prayerfully consider a gift to the Ciceronian Society today, or start to plan as part of your year-end giving. Now, today's episode is special. It features four of the 198 current members of the Society, five if you include me, reflecting on what this organization means to them, how they got involved, and what they hope the future of the Society looks like. We hope this brief window into the Ciceronian Society's vibe, if you will inspire you to attend one of our upcoming events and get to know us. Coming up very soon, for example, is our Fall Symposium, October 22nd through the 24th, 2026 in Holland, Michigan. A tentative program is now available on the website and registration is open through October 5th. Our 2027 Spring Conference will be at Regent University in Virginia Beach, March 11th through the 13th, and the proposals for that are due in just a couple days on September 1, 2026. Applications for the Logress Institute for Classical Liberal Studies are also open. We'll have more shows and information on that soon, and I hope you can join us for one of these events. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching, for liking, sharing, subscribing, and passing word along about The Sower, and for all your prayers and support. We could not do this without you, and we're so grateful. God bless you. Enjoy. Hello, I'm so happy to be joined by some great friends and familiar faces of the Ciceronian Society. Once again, my name is Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. I'm joined by Claire Aguda-Baker, who is assistant professor at Boyce College in Kentucky, Christopher Annadale, who is a professor of philosophy at Mount St. Mary's University in Maryland, Rachel Ferguson, director of the Free Enterprise Center. I got it right, at Concordia University, Chicago, among other things. And the great Bill Batchelder, who is currently in his bunker, associate professor at the Center for Civics, Culture, and Society at Cleveland State University. So great to have you all here. Our goal for this, as I said in the intro, is to just have a quick, a brief time of reflection, fun, and what's the word? Did I already say the word recollection? Okay, it's the middle of the afternoon, and I've only had so much coffee, so y'all are going to have to deal with it. But the Ciceronian Society means a lot to a lot of people. And no matter what I say in terms of its history or some fancy brochure or the website, it is impossible to really get to the heart of who we are and what we do without meeting the people that show up to our conference and show up to our boards and show up to all these things. That's what makes the difference about the Ciceronian Society. It's the kind of thing where no matter what I say on here, I understand if you don't believe me until you come to one of our conferences, until you get to know our people. They are what make the difference here by God's grace. And so I'm very, very grateful to be joined by these friends here. And this is August 6th, the Feast of the Transfiguration, I believe, in the Western Church. And it's also Wendell Berry's 92nd birthday, appropriate given our Ciceronian Society's long-running affiliation with localism to that in a way. And I think that's a good place to start. So the first question I want to ask is, do you remember how you first learned about the Ciceronian Society and the first time you attended one of our events? Claire?
Yes, I can't remember the exact time that I first heard about it, but I was working the conservative conference circuit, as it were. So Ciceronian popped up on my list, and it was in Grove City that year, which I think was 2021?
2022.
2022 was my first year. I remember looking at the program and being like, wow, this actually looks incredibly interesting. Like, I'm not just interested in one of the panels as like I normally am for other things, but I was interested in nearly all of the panels. But I was also really looking forward to meeting some people that I had read articles by and heard about over the years, but had never met in person. One of whom was Dr. John Wilsey, who teaches now my colleague at Southern Seminary. I had read his stuff and wanted to meet him forever. So I finally got to meet him and hear the laugh that you can hear from three states away in person, but also get to talk to him about a variety of things. And because of that conversation, I ended up starting my PhD work, which ultimately led me here. So I'm very grateful for that. I also met people that I didn't know that would become friends, who have since become great friends. I remember early conversations with James Patterson, where he was railing against something, and it was hilarious, and a bunch of others. So very fond memories of that first conference in Grove City.
Now, Chris, you're an OG. You've been here since before I was part of this. When did you learn about the Ciceronian Society?
Yeah, it's tough for me to believe there's been a time before the Josh Bowman at the Ciceronian Society. Right. You've just sort of been, even before we were actually hired, you know, for a paid position as our executive director, you've been the guy just sort of holding everything together with bits of string and chewing gum. So I have to say, I can plead old age here. I sort of dimly recollect that my first time going to a Ciceronian conference was back probably about 2012 or so, maybe 2012 or 2013, in one of the 2 years we had our conference at UVA. I remember meeting Peter Hayworth and some of the other people there, but I don't have a lot of clear recollection of exactly what we did. At that time, I remember driving to UVA, and I'm sort of a newish professor. Just got back to the East Coast a few years earlier, and meeting Peter Hayworth especially, and sort of talking with him about sort of his plans for the society and how he's sort of trying to sort of keep this little flame alive and growing. But we've come so far to look at the hundreds and hundreds of people at our conferences, to better part of 3 days, even 4 days sometimes, that we can fill up with conference space. It's just been amazing. The growth has been amazing, and a lot of that I know, Josh, is down to you and the work that you've done over the years. So that's unfortunately, I don't have any good sort of a recollection of that apart from the fact that, hey, it's Virginia's driving distance. Let me go check it out and help out Peter.
Rachel, you were also you learned about it pretty early on too, right?
Yeah, although I didn't attend until this sort of iteration of the Ciceronian Society, but Chris Annandale and I go way back. We have a very good shared friend, Don Livingston, and I actually wrote my dissertation on David Hume, somewhat inspired by Don and his appreciation for the concept of natural scale. And it was like he was the first person who'd ever talked about natural scale. And I was studying political philosophy. Maybe, well, Plato talks about it, but I was really fascinated by that concept, and he was very excited about the Ciceronian Society. So the name was in my mind, and yeah, when the second iteration was born, I jumped right in. And actually, at that 2022 conference, I gave a plenary talk on my book, actually on the Black Church chapter from my book, which was a great experience. And I think that's where I first met Carl Truman too. He was our keynote, and since then we've hung out quite a lot. So
That book was the subject of episode 2 of The Sower, since we're looking
that's
back now
right.
from 100 episodes. You're
Gosh,
right there, right there at the start of this
just
podcast.
laying the foundation. So
That's right.
Before I give a chance for Bill to speak, speaking of Don Livingston, I just want to give a shout out to him. He's one of the founders of the society. One of the interesting things I learned recently, I always was aware that Don was a Christian. He's specifically an Orthodox Christian, which means of the three people who started the Ciceronian Society, we had a Protestant, a Catholic, and an Orthodox, which is a key part of our identity. It always has been that we are. We relate to all those traditions, and someone who also is Orthodox, of course. We even got a picture of him here in the sunshine, with that Orthodox beard, the legend.
So much
He's not.
sunshine.
He, they let him out of his bunker. And I remember. I want to hear how Bill learned about the Ciceronian Society. But I remember my first Ciceronian Society was Peter Hayworth, of course, the founder. Introduced me. He wanted me to help with something. I want to say it was in 2013 or 2014, and he said, "You got to meet this guy named Bill Batchelder. You're gonna love him. He's crazy." Those were his exact words. Every bit of that was true. I love him, and he's crazy in all the right ways. And I'm so glad you're here, Bill.
So I met Peter. I think we were at the Northeastern Political Science Association conference because it was in Philly. So everybody slept on my floor. And it was Harding, who of course I went on to do the Reef book with. He's one of my best friends now. And it was Slack, Kevin Slack at Hillsdale. And golly, I think I had two other people sleeping on my floor, and I can't remember who else it was. And we did this panel. I'm not sure what tied that panel together, not much. But the paper, I've never topped the title. It was a paper about Chandler called Noir Enemy of the State.
That's right. I
And
remember
so,
that.
and
Nice.
great.
Nice.
so we met Peter afterward. He said, "Well, I've got this conference, and you guys should come to it. And it's at UVA, and living in Philly, I could take the Amtrak." So I was like, "Yeah, okay, I'll do that." So I did a paper on Gerald Wales for Peter at UVA, but he was super nice and gentlemanly and kind to us, and was sincerely interested in what everybody was doing. It was really solicitous of having us come to his conference, and of course, he was we all owe him a lot for founding the society. He's a great guy. So that's how I met Peter. Was he looking for the sorts of people he thought would like to come to UVA. And I don't know, Chris, was that like the third or the second Ciceronian at UVA?
I know we had two there, so I think I might have been in the second. Or
It
I
was the
think maybe our
second.
second and third were at UVA, yeah.
Okay, so it might have been your third, because I don't think I ever went back to UVA. I think the next year we were in Maryland. So I guess I was there starting at the third.
I'll be honest, this just goes to show you know how ramshackle, if you will, the beginnings were. I until today, I thought we only did one at UVA. So I need to go back and figure out what the heck happened. course, I was not at either of the ones at UVA. My first experience was at Mount St. Mary's University, where Chris is at, beautiful campus. Yeah, it was just that was a great experience. And I one thing I remember too was the Ciceronian Society has long been attractive to people who don't really fit anywhere else in their discipline or other disciplines. And it's not that they're imposters in the sense of scholarly rigor, or that they're not, are they unqualified, et cetera. It's that many academic disciplines can become so narrowly construed and so siloed in a way that keeps good scholars doing interesting, especially interdisciplinary work out. And one of the things I think that's really, really beneficial about what we do is that we're not like that, right? I mean, we'll get proposals for a conference. I'll be like, who writes on this? Oh, well, you know what? Who let's do that for the, I have no, I mean, there's definitely some times where a proposal comes through and someone is writing on an author or a topic I didn't even know was a thing. And I think to myself, that's a great opportunity. Maybe it's going to fall flat, but maybe it won't. And I, and the opportunity to dig into that is special to us. I want to head back around to Claire for our second question, because you're the one who's probably done the most to answer this question, because you've given the best answer to
Tagline.
it. Yeah. How do you describe the Ciceronian society, other society to other people? And why did you particularly come to this conclusion?
Yeah, so my tagline is the Ciceronian Society is a place for largely Christian academics, leaders, scholars, who take their faith very seriously. They take their work very seriously, but they don't take themselves very seriously, is my classic Ciceronian tagline. And I feel like, as all things, I probably had heard snippets of that from other places and put it together, or maybe I'd heard it describe something else, but it rang completely true for my experience with Ciceronian. It's my first conference. I absorbed every single panel that I could, because the topics were fascinating and varied, and you couldn't get those topics anywhere else. Tradition, place, and things divine is broad by nature, but every single panel is usually also very deep. So you can really appreciate it from both those angles. So the scholarship is excellent from that level, and it's scholars who are independent scholars coming from different institutions. There's been a few homeschool moms that have presented to scholarship from all different angles, but they're also from people who take their faith seriously. What do I mean by that? I'm not just a Christian for the namesake of it and something that someone does on Sunday, but the way that their faith shapes every aspect of their life, including their scholarship, which is also part of what makes Ciceronian unique, is it's hard to find that even in Christian organizations, that depth of faith being infused into scholarship, and studying it kind of from those angles, opposed to what's popularly available. And then to take themselves seriously, as you can see probably from every single podcast, everybody gets along and is actually friends and likes to make jokes and not take themselves too seriously. And that is a beautiful gift in and of itself. And it's, I think, the secret sauce of Ciceronian is kind of all those three things together.
Before we get to Chris, one of the things that comes to mind too is I remember being in other conferences, just whether they're discipline specific for my discipline of political science, and almost feeling like I needed not so much to apologize for the Christian perspective I brought, but being ready to defend it, or that it was a liability to my research, right? It was shaping what I was doing and what I was saying, but it felt like, oh, I better get ready for this, kind of an attitude. That's not true at Ciceronian Society. And by the way, we do have folks who come to Ciceronian Society who are not Christians or are questioning their faith. You are also welcome, because that's a huge part of our conversation. But as an organization, we are Christian, and always exploring what it means to be that way. But Chris, how do you describe us to other people?
I think I probably reached for some things that any of you could say as well. We're interdisciplinary in the sense that we're not sort of siloed in political theory or doing, just philosophy. And one of the things that people do tend to get, I think, find kind of tedious, at least I'm speaking for myself, about professional organizations is that kind of relentless sort of inward focus about the sort of the issues in the discipline. So you get a lot of really fascinating sort of cross-pollination. I'm hearing literary theory from people who've studied C.S. Lewis much more deeply than I ever have, and that's given me all sorts of ideas about things that I can use in my teaching and other areas of things that I'm doing. So interdisciplinary, ecumenical, I think, in the best sense of the word. There's an old New Yorker cartoon where there's a couple of cardinal archbishops walking through the Vatican, and there's a guy coming out of a door, and it's the devil. Right, it's a little devil with horns carrying a book under his arm, and one of the cardinals says to the other, "I think maybe we've taken ecumenism a little bit too far." Right, so I think that's kind of the opposite of what I'm thinking of here. We're not so ecumenical in the sense that there's kind of no boundaries, whatever. And I think, Josh, our specific kind of line for Christian identity of the society is the Nicene is sorry, which creed?
The Nicene Creed.
The Nicene Creed.
Yeah.
So, but within that
Specifically
boundary,
because the Orthodox, we have to say the Nicene Creed of, oh crap, what's the year? Is it 415? Am I getting that right? 425? Oh my gosh, I'm
Historians will
failing so
correct
much here.
us.
It's the first one before everyone loses their mind over the filioque. I'm obviously simplifying something really theologically important, but I'm saying that like the initial one. So if you're Orthodox, you're still welcome. Filioque aside, we're good.
Well, my idea is everybody here has been quite friendly with each other across disciplinary boundaries, across confessional boundaries. And so it's a really fascinating place to see people who are deeply involved in what they're doing, but who are also interested in reaching out and sort of sharing with other people in the kind of space that we offer at our conferences and through other events and podcasts and the like. And as far as the sort of content of the scholarship, I tend to characterize us as having a kind of sort of conservative disposition, kind of localist and some traditional or libertarian tendencies in sort of, pick one, pick two. I don't find any one person who's committed to all of those things, but we've got people who are quite strong in one or the other of those. And I think they all feel welcome. They all feel that they contributed in some really meaningful way and take something away from, get some kind of nourishment and sustenance from the kind of experiences that we can offer through our conferences and other programming.
Rachel, you've recruited a lot of people to the Ciceronian Society. What do you say?
I call the Ciceronians the joyful conservatives. And it's a sad commentary on how people generally think of conservatives as being sour, perhaps, or something. But we are a fun group. Bill McClay from Hillsdale said we were a whole vibe. I feel like that should be quoted.
That's right, yep.
And there is a lot of self-deprecation and joking and so forth, which I love. I also just think that, the stereotype of conservative thought has totally lost the thread of the way that conservatives are sort of anthropologists and sociologists. They're looking very closely at cultural practices that lead to human flourishing, right? The way that the family is structured, the way that the church is structured, the way that certain kinds of cultural practices are structured. And there's genuine interest in that, whatever tradition you're looking at, right? You're interested in cultures and how they preserve themselves. And I don't think that, because of the left's sort of takeover of those particular areas, I don't think people put that together in their minds. That's an obvious interest of conservatives. So the fact that back in 22, I think one of the first sessions we had was three Eastern Orthodox guys talking about things very specific to their tradition. And I thought, okay, this is true conservatism, right? We want to know about your tradition and your customs and what they do to help you navigate life. And so I think that's one of the coolest things about it and kind of a rehabilitation of true conservatism.
Yeah. Looks like Bill just walked to his off-grid cabin, sitting at his table. What's what how when how do you describe the Ciceronian society?
Well, I mean, we've been broadly Christian. Obviously, I think there'd be no reason that Protestants or Catholics or Orthodox would be uncomfortable. And of course, that's a tremendous thing. We won't tolerate the vile heresy of Patripassianism. But other than that,
What did you just say?
Patripassianism, that Annandale should know that one.
That's really nerdy. I feel like you need to define that
It's
for the
the failure to separate the crucifixion of the Son from his relational existence with the Father.
That was a really deep cut, Bill. I don't.
We check for that at the door.
Every day,
Yeah,
everybody's
that's
welcome,
welcome, except
apparently I
those
failed
times.
because I don't even know what it means.
No, but we have been. It's been a. It's very. What's interesting is there is all. I have never heard any kind of denominational or confessional dispute ever. It just doesn't come up. So people may be different, and they may talk about how their particular traditions are different. But I have never sat in a panel where it devolved into a dispute between denominations or confessions, which I think is really significant, that people understand what's at stake in the questions of modernity, and have refocused the prioritization of difference accordingly. And I do think that's important, and it's something that I've always been particularly pleased with about the Ciceronian Society. It's a great thing. And it's a great thing that we've been welcoming to people of no faith. Obviously, you have to have a confession that you can sign to be a member of the society, but you most certainly don't to attend panels or to sign up for a conference or even to present at a conference. And so that kind of patient tolerance among people that are actually committed, it's one thing to be tolerant if you don't actually believe in anything. That's not effortful. But you have people that do believe deeply and have these things shape their scholarship, but they still don't, they're not spoiling for a fight with people that have confessional differences. And I think that's been really significant.
Yeah, it's been very helpful. I know we definitely have had people who they found it refreshing because kind of what Bill just said, like it's an effortful tolerance, like in the sense that we have things we genuinely believe, but we have the humility and grace that says, look, we don't know everything. There are some things we're very, very confident about. The words of the Nicene Creed don't keep me up at night. I believe every word of it. But at the same time, I understand that people struggle. And this is to use an overused word, if you're struggling intellectually with Christianity and you want to get someone to take you seriously, that'd be a really fun conversation to have at lunch, right? I think I'm 100% encouraging to folks who are there, or it's just a, now it could be, the conversations I've had are, well, so Josh, you the Anglican, what do you think about Mary? Like, oh no, here we go. Like, I gotta work here, okay? It's or the Pope, right? There's always those kind of things, but that usually ends up devol not devolving, but evolving into a lot of fun. We can certainly get into that. And it just blows my mind when I think about the animosity that these different confessions at different places in the world today even have with each other. It doesn't even occur to me, and I'm always encouraged by that. This is my next question, going back to Claire. Is there a particular presentation or panel or speaker in the years we've been doing this that just sticks out in your mind from a Ciceronian Society conference that just it lingered with you, or it had an impact on your research, or something like that. We can't hear you.
I
Take off
knew
your.
it was going to
It's
happen.
like a
I knew it was
seance.
going to happen if I did that one. Okay, we're on. We're good. Okay.
We're good.
So, impacted scholarship, thought deeply about, think deeply throughout the year, all of the above. I always like hearing the update from CRCD on the Religious Liberty in the States project. We do that every year, just kind of a practical way to talk about what's going on in terms of religious liberty. One panel that stuck with me for a while was one that Josh Herring put together on C.S. Lewis and gender, which I think is the topic of his book. Just kind of some thoughts that he had had about that in terms of projects that have sparked my research. There was a panel at this last conference on Virtue and the Founders. Jonathan Din Hartog's writing book on John Jay, which I know is going to be amazing because he's a fantastic scholar. And Dennis Durst did a paper on Benjamin Rush, and that's part of my research. So I went and talked to him, and I think I have it close by here. He gave me his paper, so I have it to reference for that. So nerdy fun from Cicerone being able to attend all those kind of panels. But also just on the topic that we were just talking about in terms of the ecumenism, I would also like to note that all of the Protestant Catholic and Orthodox branches are represented on this call.
Yeah.
We all, I have, I will say that I have learned so much from everybody on this call, but also from the society coming from those different perspectives. It does remind me of iron sharp iron in lots of ways. So I'm not one to get into the nitty gritty of the theological differences debate. I prefer people to get along usually, but we do get along at these conferences, and it's always really encouraging to hear from those different perspectives.
And Claire
Yeah.
is a Baptist, so that's saying a lot.
That's saying a lot. That's saying a lot.
Someone's got to drive us home. Okay.
Exactly.
Chris, what's the panel that you remember?
I got to say from this most recent conference just a few months ago, the Lovecraft panel I thought was just fantastic. And to think here we're getting together sort of a decades old and more almost what more than decade old Christian society of scholars, and here's a panel of three papers on H.P. Lovecraft and the mythology the mythos behind his work. I thought that was just a fantastic panel. That was the final day of our conference. It was very enjoyable for me, and I took a lot away from that. I was at the conference with my daughter, who's a college student, and she really loved that too. I was asking lots of questions afterwards. So I got to say, as far as that's not a place you're going to get. It's not a not. The type of topic you're going to get at any conference, much less any Christian conference or conference of conservative Christians, but I think we pulled it. That one really pulled it off, and it really impressed me a great deal.
Yeah, Rachel.
Well, you know, I have to talk about neighborhood stabilization because that's my wheelhouse. But I was actually very impressed with our choice to do a panel on fragile neighborhoods by Seth Kaplan. And we brought in and then I was on one of the responders. But the reason I say that is because I think there's a really cool crossover between scholarship and practical concerns in our group. It's not just about being, you know, having egghead conversations, right? It's how does this actually play out in life and help people to flourish, and questions about the natural scale of a neighborhood, but also how do you rebuild a neighborhood when it's fallen apart? And that's obviously very close to my heart, but there's a lot of ways in which we bring practical questions in. We've had presentations on people talking about how to blend being trained in tech. Right? Or I should say a tech school, craftsmanship, right? Being trained in craftsmanship, along with the liberal arts or with religious training and the way you can blend them and those sorts of things, which is so important right now as everyone wakes up to the ROI of college, you know, depending on your major, right? And thinks, I'm not sure if this is the direction I should go, right? And so, yeah, I just really value that we're willing to like jump from the intellectual to the practical, but keep the connection going between the two.
Bill, you've given many of the most memorable presentations, but I'm just wondering if there's one that you particularly remember from someone else.
That Lovecraft panel had about 100% more Aleister Crowley than you typically get at a Christian conference.
You need to put a trigger warning on the door. Bill's here.
So, I think going back a few years, you hate to give him credit, but one of the best papers that I heard, and one of the ones that really stuck with me, is John Wilsey explaining how Christians really ought to think about American exceptionalism, and especially how they ought not to. And I thought that you know, obviously, there's a whole book written around that, but that was the first idea that I'd heard those concepts. I'd intuited some of it. I'd never thought through it in a profound and mature way. I again hate to give him that credit either. That Wilsey had. It was just a remarkable paper, one that's really stuck with me. Another one is when Michael Harding worked through what Locke would think of modern nation building and the American Empire. His conclusion was not much, but that was Michael Harding's paper on that was, I thought, was outstanding. I really remember that very well. That Kaplan panel was terrific. I remember that very well as well. I mean, those are three that just jump right out at me. I know there's been others, but those are the three that have sort of leapt out at me as particular papers that I got a lot out of.
Yeah, the Lovecraft panel stands out to me, because Bill had, for those of you who weren't there, Bill turned off the lights and then put a big picture of Cthulhu on the screen, which was
Perfect. It's exactly what it should have been, and it was really well done.
Creepy.
I'm sure I could identify specific panels or papers. One of the, since I run the conference, one of the things I typically that stick in my mind are the moments where, okay, is this a crazy person? Like, is this person going to say something nuts I did not anticipate? Because if you come to the Cicerone, like, look, this is true with any conference you go to, no matter how well the screening process is. Some interesting people will still get through. Let's just put it that way.
Yes,
Listen, we love you. You're there. I remember it actually was a compelling paper on demonology, for example, that I did not expect. And then just papers that are fun. I mean, every time Ethan gets up to speak in his majestic voice, it is fantastic.
the best,
Josh, I also
Josh.
see. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, could I ask you, just for the sake of thinking of maybe first time viewers, members of the audience who might be somewhat alarmed by hearing about the picture of Cthulhu in a darkened room,
Oh,
could we
yeah.
just mention that the purpose of Bill's paper and why it was that a Lovecraft panel was both proposed, accepted, and delivered at our conference? I brought it up because I thought it was really quite exceptional, but I
Yes.
think maybe we owe people a little bit more information than we've given them so
We
far.
were not we're not saying that Lovecraft is like, we're not baptizing Lovecraft. Can we make sure, I mean, maybe Bill, you can say something about that for
No,
those of you who are like, okay,
you're
are
not
these
going
like
to
some
manage
secret
that.
pagans? What'd you say, Bill?
You're not going to manage to baptize Lovecraft. No.
No.
What we were working through, one of the papers worked through Eliade's ideas and how those are reflected in Lovecraft. Another one of the papers worked through Lovecraft's particular form of atheism, and the fact that if you look at Philip Reeves, for example, his theory about myth building in a post-Christian world, what that looks like, and what some of the real problems with attempting to do that kind of myth building are in a post-Christian and a post-religious world, and some critiques of Lovecraft's, what he called his cosmicism, which was Lovecraft's particular form of atheism, and how his, what's interesting about Lovecraft is his despairing nothing inspires so much something in his writing. And so we were working through those issues in particular, because of course, if you want to have a Christian conference in 2026 that doesn't confront unbelief and
Right.
doesn't confront the fact that we're in a culture largely either of unbelief or ersatz myth, then you're not really very well in connection with the things that are around you. And so this combination of unbelief and sort of ersatz myth, and there's almost nobody better than Lovecraft for that. And so these were largely the issues that were being explored by all three of the panelists.
And I would take a minute to point out too, one of the things I think is among Christian organizations as well. This is very much a safe place to engage for a Christian to engage non-Christian thinkers and writers,
Yes.
and to take them seriously. I mean, this is certainly true of the ancient Greeks and Romans, which are the best example here. But Lovecraft or Reef or all these people, it's I and it's we have to read. We live in a world that is not thoroughly Christian. If we want to understand it and engage it seriously, these are ways that we can practice doing so. I'm so grateful for opportunities like that. And yeah, I mean, does it always go perfectly well? No, but I think it does go over well. There are so many times where it goes even better than I expected. And I also remember moments where, and I want to encourage people with this. It's a great place for a early career scholar to try out an idea or to get some feedback. And I can distinctly remember moments where someone who is in grad school, let's say they're in grad school, no one really knows who they are yet. They haven't published anything. They've showed up. This is their first conference. They presented a paper. And more than one person will say, did you hear that paper? Or did you know that there's someone who's, it's like that's someone who's going to make a splash. They're going to write their first book, and people are going to read this one, right?
And one of the motivations for having the conference at all is to make sure that junior scholars have an opportunity to participate in a conference that's not going to charge them an obscene amount of money and force them to pay for a hotel room in Washington, D.C. or Seattle. The point of this is that it's supposed to be, one hates to use the word nurturing, but at least that it's supposed to be helpful. It's supposed to be an outreach toward young Christian scholars who are getting started. It's supposed to be affordable. It's supposed to be attainable. And we've gone to some length to make sure that that continues to be one of our organization's goals, that we are attempting to be of service to Christian academics, not simply make money off the existence of Christian academics. And that's a bunch of Josh's conference planning is what makes that manageable, and which we all really appreciate, because we want to meet these junior scholars and we want to see this up and coming work, and we want to give an opportunity to be heard.
And sometimes I also starve my children. So that's also part of what I'm just kidding. I'm just, I
Only
really, sh
the
I should starve myself. That's actually what I should do more
bad.
often. For those of you who can't see, you can only see the pretty, right now, you can only see the pretty part of me. This is why I do podcasts. Anyways, moving on before anyone can comment on that. How would you say, go over to Claire, and Claire has a pretty clear answer here. How would you say the Ciceronian Society has impacted you professionally, whether in terms of employment or research? Like, how has this impacted you?
Yes, essentially, in all the ways, which is why I will do this for you, Josh. I am a donor to the Ciceronian Society to continue this good work and provide opportunities for young scholars, such as I am, baby scholar, to present their papers. So you should be too. Donate at the Ciceronian Society website. But I owe my job to the Ciceronian Society in a couple different ways. The most obvious one was my current dean was looking for somebody to fill the politics position, and he ran across my name on the Ciceronian Society program, where I was giving my very first paper on culture, which is a paper that I could probably only give at the Ciceronian Society. A lot of the scholarship that went into that paper was influenced by people that I had met and got to know and formed friendships with at the Ciceronian Society, such as Dr. Jewell, Dr. Willsey, etc. So I very much owe a lot of my professional career and a lot of my real life professional friends to the Ciceronian Society. So donate.
Chris.
Yeah, well, I think the role it's played in my life the past decade or more is it's really very quickly become the only conference I go to on the regular basis. And my memory of being a junior scholar is that you go to, in my case, and perhaps Rachel in your case as well, you go to the APA and you just hate it. It's just, unless maybe you're one of the sort of the best of the best, the top people presenting or being sought after on the job market. If you're anywhere outside of that kind of talented tenth, you just sort of suffer through a lot of the conference for a lot of reasons in a lot of ways. I won't be any more specific, but the Ciceronian Society has always been very welcoming and very enjoyable. And it's another one of those phrases I should perhaps put on a t-shirt. I feel like I've found my people. I found a group of people with whom I feel comfortable while I'm there. I feel refreshed when I come back to the daily tasks of teaching and grading and planning and all the and committee meetings and all the things that we do as academics. But it's the conference that I feel good at, and it's the conference that I feel good going to, and even spending some money to get to if it's not nearby to where I'm at. So that's been really its role for me. It's a conference that I feel good about going to and having gone to.
Rachel.
Yeah, well, I'm a professor at Concordia University Chicago, which is Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we hire across. We're ecumenical in our hiring, but same as Concordia, as Ciceronian, we want everyone to be creedal. And so one of the great advantages has been as soon as there's a job available at Concordia, I send it straight to the Ciceronian list. And get applicants from the Ciceronian list because I just know that they'll fit right in and be great at Concordia. So that's been a big one. And then this last year I brought students with me. So one of the surprising things at my Free Enterprise Center is that a bunch of theology students want to be a part of my Free Enterprise Center that are all, pre-seminarians and things like that. And so when I think about, well, I'm not going to send them off to an econ conference at IHS. That's not going to be their interest. Several of them, I thought, oh my gosh, these kids should be at Ciceronian and be thinking about that for their seminary studies. Kids who are the head of the pro-life group on campus and things like that. So yeah, that and they loved it and had an amazing time this last year.
Bill.
Yeah, I think that Christian broad Christian toleration also means that there's a much more profound bond between the people that are at this conference than simply political. I mean, we all know of conferences that are largely oriented around politics, either they admit it or they don't. But it's oriented around a certain worldview that everyone agrees upon. But that is a much more shallow way of having these intellectual engagements, I think, in a lot of ways, than being grounded in a sort of a very, very similar metaphysic, like we all are. And so I do think that that's makes a huge difference that we have people that completely disagree politically, and it's not an issue because we're bonded by deeper things than that. And so I can testify to Concordia's Ciceronian pre-screening, nothing makes me happier than to hear Claire talk about the direct correlation between her current employment, much deserved, and the fact that she had been involved in Ciceronian. I mean, that is why the board, which she is now part of, that is why the board does what the board does. That's why we do what we do. And so that boy, that makes me very, very happy to hear. And I encourage junior scholars, don't be shy. And I my friend Dave, I haven't talked to him in a while. He's my grad school friend. I asked him what conferences were like very early on in grad school. And he's not a Ciceronian guy. He's just a guy that I was friends with in grad school, a good fellow. And he said, it's soul crushing. You walk into the reception and everyone's eyes, they don't look you in the eye. Their eyes go straight to your name tag. And as soon as they see grad student or independent scholar, they go find someone else to talk to. And that is just not what happens at Ciceronian. It is not. And that honestly wouldn't be tolerated among the officers. That is not what we do. And I think that that's important.
In fact, that's one of the reasons why when you register or you propose a paper, you don't have to put an affiliation. We put it's optional. I would say most people do it, but it's not required. And it doesn't really affect whether or not you're going to get accepted. Just 'cause, if you put Harvard, first of all, it might be the first one, maybe the second one, maybe the second one. then we're going to look and say, oh, okay, but it's not going to make a difference of. Whether or not you get it, if the paper is a good proposal or not. I also think one thing that is taken for granted among scholars, it's not just about CV lines, those matter. Yes, networking and connections matter. Of course they do. But it's very hard to keep at something when you don't have friends that are also kind of alongside you, right? And I think that friendship is so important to what we do. It also has helped sustain people who are not in academia anymore, right? Who think to themselves, I'm really interested in reading this stuff. I don't want to be a professor. I don't want to go to these conferences. But we have a guy who's been on the podcast before, Bert Norton. Great guy. He reads Philip Reeve for fun and then writes on him. The guy is fantastic. And where is he going to go to talk about this stuff? In the answer is the Ciceronian Society. Another thing that I think is both professionally and personally helpful for many people is, I'll at least speak from the evangelical Protestant perspective that I grew up in. Being a intellectual, smart Christian seems to be an oxymoron for some people. It just seems to be there's an anti-intellectualism that in some cases is deserved, quite frankly, but it's not, as I wrote in my intellectual discipleship article, it's not, it doesn't make sense ultimately that being a smart Christian is okay, right? Or at least trying to be, right? And to take the intellectual side of Christianity seriously, or just take the intellectual side of life seriously, is a gift of God. And so we hope that anyone who comes to join us for that can experience that as well. Now, one of the things that I have heard on multiple occasions from people who first come to our conference is they've never heard so much laughter. Half of it is Bill and Wilsey, because Bill actually he's laughing right now. You can't tell, but I can hear it from here in Michigan. He's in Ohio. And yeah, Wilsey, you can hear it on the moon. I hope he watches this so he hears me say that. But are there any particularly funny stories to share? I'm going to start with one. There's always some weird phrase that gets picked up at a given conference. It comes from a paper. The first one that I can remember was Bill did a paper on is it Albert or Alfred Jaynock?
It was Albert J. Nock, yeah.
Albert Jaynock.
I
Couldn't
know
think of
who
his.
you're going with this.
Yeah, Albert Jaynock, and he said one of Nock's quotes referred to human beings as psychically anthropoid. Which is so offensive in many ways, like to just refer to people as just psychically anthropoid. You're not, but it was hilarious. Like, you know, now I can say to Bill, like, you know, stop. You're just being psychically anthropoid. Or I don't know if this is meant to be a G-rated podcast, but I remember Dennis Durst was he was quoting someone from one of the Great Awakenings, and he referred to one
It
of
was
those
a
people.
political attack on Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, political.
It was
Well,
one that was a political attack on Thomas Jefferson.
And he call and they're referring to the concubines of the Illuminati, which needs to be a t-shirt,
A
a
bam.
band.
Yeah.
Like it's so such a strange phrase that I cannot, it never comes, you know, it just never goes away. But
It was
those are,
if Jefferson was elected, everyone's daughters would be turned into concubines of the Illuminati.
just to be clear, that was not Dennis Durst's opinion. That was whoever he was quoting, but it was so funny. Because it was just not a phrase that anyone had ever put together in their life. That was the kind of thing you get at Ciceronian Society. Claire, is there a particular moment that comes to your mind?
Several, but one general topic is car rides. So I know there was one year, I think it was an early year, where Rachel and I went out to go get chocolate for hospitality
Oh yeah, because
because
I forgot. I forgot. I remember.
So
Don't
candy
just
from
want
the
alcohol,
Baptist
guys.
list.
We need
chocolate.
We need chocolate. That's our treat. So that was always very fun. There was the year we were in Plano. The hotel was right by an interstate, and I definitely drove people on the wrong way on a one way near the interstate. So thank you to everybody who has ridden with me, going to and from Cicerone conferences. But also speaking of car rides, this last year, there were several of us who were stranded in Nebraska because of storms and travel and whatnot. So I ended up driving Dr. John Wilsey with my husband back to Kentucky. We got hit by tornado warnings. We fled a storm going like 85 miles an hour trying to flee the storm. But there were several great Wilseyisms that were shared during the 12-hour drive. My favorite would be talking about the Great British Baking Show. He said he would rather drink a bullet through a straw than watch the Great British Baking Show. So that was one of my highlights for those car rides, but several funny stories with car rides. Prayers for anyone who drives with me around to Ciceronian Society conferences in the future.
How about you, Chris?
Well, I just have to say, because 12 hours in a car with John Wilsey racing ahead of a storm and tornadoes just sounds like a Flannery O'Connor story that we all need, you
It
know.
was
So,
I live tweeted some of it, that so
I
it was
remember.
worth it.
That's fantastic. My story is not really a public one, but it does involve Peter Hayworth, whom we all esteem greatly. So I'm going to tell it. I don't know that I've told this story to any of you guys before. This would have been way back around the time that we were doing the society meetings in the mid-teens at my school. And I had gone down to Frederick, Maryland, which is not where I live. It's about a half hour away from where I live, but it's a big town. And I'd gone out with my wife to dinner, and we walked into the Macaroni Grill. I remember what restaurant it was, chain restaurant it was.
Clearly, they pay well at Mount St. Mary's. Oh man. That's, I'm just kidding.
I
I'm
went
just
into, as I was saying,
I'm so sorry.
went into the restaurant, and I'm standing there right inside the door with my wife waiting to be seated. And a man gets up from the bar and walks directly over to us and says to me, "Are you Christopher Annandale?" And I had this sort of stunned feeling that something dramatic is going to happen. It may not be I've seen mobster movies, and I what? Yes. So, and it was Peter Hayworth. He was actually was driving up to talk to my colleague Josh Hochschild, and meet him, and he knew my picture from the website, on the university website, and he came, and I think we had met before, maybe at a conference, the previous year or two, but we said he had stopped at that restaurant to have dinner. He was working on his laptop at the bar and having a quick meal before he finished the last half hour of the drive up to the where the university was. So that was my kind of first and last time I've ever been recognized in public by somebody. It was Peter Hayworth just coming right up to me out of nowhere. No, aren't you? And I said, well, yes, I am. So he introduced himself and we said goodbye, said hello, goodbye, and I went and had dinner. So it's an uncanny experience, I have to tell you, but for
And
someone from
set your
background.
destiny, Chris, for the Ciceronian Society podcast
Yep.
producer.
Absolutely.
There you go. Rachel, do you have a particular funny, like a particular funny story other than the chocolate that I clearly forgot to
Yes. No, I can't believe we've gotten this far on the podcast without talking about James Patterson. I
Oh yeah, that's
mean,
right. Yeah.
he's
He's
basically
ridiculous.
a walking stand-up comedian.
It's yeah.
And
A
I
walking
can't
comedian.
imitate him, so I can't do the just, I can't do justice to the story. But my two students and I were talking. It was one of these late night conversations, where we really should be in bed, but we're still talking. And James, and feel free to edit this out, Chris, if it's inappropriate, but James
This is going to be great.
started to explain the 4chan to crazy right-wing nutcase pipeline. And how you can it all the way back to the 4chan days. And he starts just using all of these terms that I don't know because I have never been on 4chan in my whole life. But my students know what he's talking about and they are crying. I mean, because here's a guy in middle age explaining all of this kind of stuff to them that they're recognizing. And it was so funny, but at the same time, very profound, right? Because we're dealing with a lot of very strange things on the new right, and so he's going back and making this cultural explanation, but we were truly crying from laughing. It was so funny. He is hilarious, just consistently.
Chris, when you're editing this, I want you, and you're going to have to do it here right now. I want you to edit out the word because this censoring it will actually be even funnier because no one will know what I just said or what James discovered on 4chan. It'll
Right.
be perfect. But anyways, Bill, you're responsible for many of the funnier stories. What are some that you remember where you just laughed till you cried or something?
Well, I remember the first time I hung out with Harding at a Ciceronian thing, I think there were four of us at a table and we didn't realize it was 4 in the morning because I guess this is a little loud for 4 in the morning at the hotel. So yeah, I mean, the one thing you definitely notice is that the time flies, and that's I think it is one of those things where people really are their guard is the reason people can tell all these funny stories is people's guard is actually down, and my guard is not always down in the other professional environments, you know what I mean? But it's Ciceronian people really do, just say what they're thinking and are comfortable, and again, not because they all agree either. I've seen some intense disagreements, but then everybody's friends. We had one over AI at the last conference, did we not? There was a panel where it got fairly heated, but then. Well, nobody left. Nobody was mad. Nobody stayed mad. So you can. I think the key is that people not taking themselves seriously means that they could be more open, that they could be more funny. It means they can disagree intensely without feeling like this is an attack on them, or this was an attempt to show up their panel, or make them feel vulnerable because they don't agree. And we've all been through peer reviews where we dared to say something that the dominant boomer scholar in our field disagrees with, and so now it's going to take twice as long for the book to get published or whatever. I haven't had that happen, thank God. I've actually been quite supported in my field, But man, I mean, if all of us had a nickel for every horror story we've heard, where the whole point of the book is because it disagrees with the scholars in the field, but the scholars in the field don't like that. So now we're going to hold up the publication of the book. There's just none of that. There is none of that. And so these stories about people, you know, being able to hang out socially, and it is because these are not people that take themselves terribly seriously. This is a very open environment, and as a result, people can disagree intensely. They can laugh intensely, because the stakes are low. It is not an environment where people are attempting to crawl over somebody else to get where they're going. And I think all of that is what's behind this.
And Josh, I
Go
should issue a warning. If you take pictures at the Ciceronian Society or selfies with people, John Wilsey will photobomb you. He will
Yes, sir.
dash across the room to get into your picture. So just be aware of that. You got to scan for Wilsey when you're taking pictures.
I need to get him to photobomb me when anyone takes a picture from from the back. That way you don't know. What do my children call it? Like this, they're like, do you have a hole in your head, Dad? Like, no, it's just receding hairline.
It's a bald spot.
It's a bald spot. That's the word, whatever. And I just want, like, stop. Like, you can only take a picture of me from this. Like, this, remember, this is the pretty side. Last question for y'all. This has been a lot of fun, and I'm really, really grateful for it. If you had the foresight to see what the Ciceronian society looks like in 10 years, what would you hope to see? And Chris can edit out the awkward silence if you need a minute. So.
I would say the people who take their faith seriously, who take their scholarship seriously, but don't take themselves seriously. Still, I hope that we continue this same trajectory that we're on. We're thanks in large part to Josh's tireless work. We are much more polished and professional and a real shop now. We're making contributions in so many different directions. I hope to keep that same spirit that we have, that we will continue to have, while following this trajectory towards becoming more polished, more professional, more opportunities for scholars from all different areas to participate. So keeping up the good work is what I hope to see.
Yeah, I'd love to see us, of course, larger and better known in 10 years. But I would love to see Ciceronian Society become a kind of go-to place for academic support for people, intellectual support, intellectual community for people outside of the academy. I'm thinking of homeschooling parents, classical school teachers, even just sort of fugitive scholars or guys like Bert Norton who've got very interesting intellectual projects to do and would like an outlet for it and a community to discuss it with rather than publishing on Substack alone. But I think if we could grow into be a kind of place like that, perhaps even as we get larger and larger, keeping scale in mind. Having maybe smaller regional meetings and communities of people who would get together, say in the Philadelphia area or, in the Omaha area, under the sort of Ciceronian banner or lecture series, the types of things that would really enrich people's lives, the lives of people who are really interested in intellectual rigor, and that fits with their Christian faith and with their sort of attempt to, live out a really clear identity that takes the intellect seriously and takes the demands of truth seriously, but doesn't see them as in any way, opposed to the commands of faith and really sort of has the absolute best of both worlds. If we could be a kind of, outside the academy or academy adjacent resource for people in those walks of life, I'd say that's a fantastic success for us in 10 years.
Rachel?
Building on what Chris just said,
Yeah.
I also hope that it's a place where people are networking and supporting each other. We all know the contrary winds that Christian academia is going to be facing, and that academia in general is going to be facing as the United States becomes, frankly, a poorer nation, and as we have the demographic dip in the number of people going to college and all these other adverse circumstances for academia and for the liberal arts, of course. Everything I just said is that, but worse. And so it is my sincere hope that we find ways of routine and regular support for people who are in career transition, who are searching for careers, and who need, perhaps it's actually logistical support or career support, perhaps it's just moral support and advice. But building on what Chris said of being a wider service, I do hope that we're able to be a deeper service to people engaged in Christian scholarship as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rachel.
These are great, guys. Wow. One of the things that you and I have discussed, Josh, is bringing in maybe more Black conservatives or Latino conservatives into the movement. I think that, you know, politically, conservatives have not done a good job of being appealing to a lot of those groups. And yet, we keep repeating the, you know, the research, right? Which is that these groups tend to be very socially conservative, very religious, very patriotic, right? There's just no reason why that shouldn't be happening. But I think it's because they don't have the joyful conservatism, right, to be inviting people into. And so I love the idea of being a really welcoming place that could say, you know, there's a group called the Black Conscious Conservatives that Josh and I were talking about that are super creative about Black wealth building, and they've got great ideas. And he's like, we should bring these guys in for a panel, you know? And so I would love to see more of that in our group as well, just to represent the actual diversity, ethnic diversity of conservatism in the United States, because it's not represented by our political parties, but it is true in reality. And so I'd like to see it come through at Ciceronian.
There's so many ways in which that, you know, our tagline, tradition, place, and things divine, it is not, what's the word, exclusive to any race or ethnicity at all, right? In fact, it'd be really interesting to explore more about how the concept of place is different across different races and ethnicities and countries, and there's so much opportunity there, and all are welcome. So I'm so grateful for that. Friends, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your support of the Ciceronian Society. Thank you for all your friendship. And I also want to make sure I thank Chris Annadale edits this podcast. We're at episode 100, which is crazy. Woo-hoo! You know, and we don't even pay him. And we're at 100, you know, so if you, I'm going to start the Pay Chris Fund. So if you give a donation today and it just says Pay Chris, we're happy to do that. Cause
sure,
I would love
I'm
to
sure
pay
you
for
can't make that promise that there's some sort of legal barrier to that.
So. You know, there probably is some kind of thing. I don't know if I can do that. But I want to.
Thank you very much. I'm very great. I'm very gratified.
And it's very helpful. So, all right, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. As a reminder, we have a second podcast discussing Cicero's seminal work on duties that is released every Wednesday morning. Be sure to take a look at that one as well. We also have the Fall Symposium and the Spring Conference. Proposals for that are due in just a few days from the airing of this episode on September 1. Now, we also have our journal Pietas, the annual Herbert Storing Prize, the new Logres Institute, and more. Make sure to sign up for our newsletter to stay on top of everything involving the Ciceronian Society. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.